All right, welcome back to the Turfcast podcast today. We took a bit of a hiatus, and we apologize for that, but there were so many people clamoring for us to get back on here that I had to twist his hand a little bit to get back on here, but actually it was pretty much my fault because I've been so busy, but...
No, same here. I was, I think we were probably a week away from some strongly worded letters being sent to our house, you know, so I'm glad that... we could make the time today, but yeah, it's been busy here, and you know, looking at your channel, it's been equally as busy, and you're all over the place, man. Where have you been and what have you been doing?
I'm all over the place. I've been working on renovations like crazy. I think people maybe on YouTube too are getting a little sick of my renovation stuff because I haven't posted a whole lot of other things than that, and I'm kind of seeing a little deep dive, but it is what it is. I have so many things going on. Next year, I told myself though that I'm going to focus more probably on my own projects than maybe the other ones, just because I feel like now I'm in a rush to get a bunch of things done at my house, but that's how it goes. So I have been working on the project across the street, which is it's looking pretty good right now, actually. We just did and overseed this past week of a few of the areas that were still pretty thin after about a month. We've had some difficult weather, a whole week of like 95 and really low humidity and wind, and it was really difficult to keep that going, but everything's still pretty much going there. And then I spent about 3 or 4 days out on the project that's kind of out in the country that's seeding 2 acres worth, so that was quite a bit of work too, and we just haven't had any rain still, so it was like the dust bowl out there.
Yeah, I saw that video, that most recent one, I think that came out yesterday, where you guys did that seeding, and I mean, it turned out great. I know we talked a little bit about it off the air, where, you know, about using like the Harley rake and that sort of thing, but man, that seed bed, it looked really, really good. And then I was curious. So when you were talking about the spreader there, where that seed was, you know, having trouble coming out, was it just sort of like bridging right there on that screen?
I felt like it, because it felt like when I was driving, you would see it get a good even flow, and then all of a sudden it would like slow down, and then you'd be watching again, and it would like kind of come in bursts almost, to where it felt like you could tell that the seed just wasn't consistently flowing down there. So we took out that screen, and then it seemed to work fine from there. So it was just figuring that out. And then obviously there's some things that I would like to do, but you have such a huge area to cover. You know, I would have liked to have covered the whole thing with some sort of covering on some of the seed, but we raked some of that in again, like with the drag, after we put that on the main areas, and just kind of have to let it go to be what it is. It did rain there. I pretty much got missed again, like usual, but it did rain like, I think he said about a half an inch the one day. And so I don't know what's going to happen. The thing about that big area out there is that he can always kind of cut that down to be not as much lawn if he doesn't want it to be, but
yeah. And that's what I think in that sense, I don't think it's going to be a tough growing. I mean, I think obviously, like you were saying on the video, the dormant seed is definitely going to have to come into play because it's not going to fill in evenly and all that. And the risk that you run, everybody, you know, talks about, you know, whatever it is, peat moss or hydro mulch or straw or whatever you want to use as a covering. You know, they talk about that for holding in moisture, but the biggest reason that you put that stuff out there, especially in the initial portion of the project, is erosion control. Mm-hmm. You know, so when you get that hard pounding rain and you've got 700 pounds of seed out there, you don't want it to wash into all the low areas, because that's, you know, I've seen that, you see that a lot on golf courses, you know, when they seed golf courses and, you know, they've got those big undulations in the fairways and the roughs and things like that, is same thing. Like, they're not able to blow in covering on those types of areas, again, just for the same reason you said, you know, because it's such a large acreage. And so, yeah, if you get a hard pounding rainstorm before that stuff really even takes root, all of your drains are glowing green, and then all the high spots are just like brown.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny.
Yeah. So, and I think that, like you said, the dormant seeding can come into play. And then also that was what we were just worried about out in those main areas, because on the, if you see the video on the eastern side, like the driveway goes pretty much straight down, and then we seated on each side of it, not as much on the western side, but he was talking about that too. I think he did put some straw down along the driveway on the other side, because that was the problem that he's been having this year, is that it's just been washing continually off. Like, it's not a huge hill by any means, but there's enough of a slope there, and you're just dealing with that loose soil that it just comes down onto the driveway. So yeah, so I mean, I'm excited to kind of see. He told me yesterday that there was some seed that had germinated up around the house, at least, because that was where he's doing most of the straw work. So yeah, it's going to be interesting, but it's just kind of a learning curve for as you go along, and still dealing with some crabgrass pressure over in my other renovation, but did another round of tenacity over there, and I was going to do some quinclorac on that, but then we needed to do that overseeding, and I just didn't want to like kind of play with that at this point. But I see a number on Tuesday of a high of 56 and a low of 42 here. So,
you know, I saw that forecast this morning, and I thought it was like April Fool's Day or some bullshit or something, but Denver is going to be like 90 or like touching 100, right? So like this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and then Tuesday, like 40 degrees for the high, and they've got snow, like an inch or two of snow coming in.
That's crazy.
I'm a four season guy, but I don't know if I could do that. That's a little extreme.
Yeah, it's supposed to be 98 here on Sunday, and then it's supposed to be 56 on Tuesday, but what I did see was maybe, you know, that kind of like fall rain weather that's not heavy rain, but that could be that could be good for the project. So we'll see.
Guns N' Roses wrote a song about that, Ryan.
Well, let's talk about some of the projects then that you're working on, because I think you have been just as busy as I have been, but it's been on some different things.
Yeah. You know, it's been the start. So high school sports started here a couple weeks back. And so, you know, a lot of these clients of mine were not necessarily flat footed, but just trying to get everything ready to go. So we went through a whole period where, you know, people were trying to, you know, scale back on budgets as much as possible and, you know, wait and see and wait and see. And then finally it was, I mean, it was literally, I think we had, 4 or 5 days notice that, hey, you're good to go, you can play. And then, you know, there was an anticipation that that would happen. But so that led to just, you know, being really busy and trying to get things ready to go. And then as a result of that, of all those scheduling changes and everything like that, that that Bermuda grass field that we've talked about before, that stadium field, they actually got a game scheduled with their arch rival right across town, and ESPN wanted to broadcast it. So it was played and on the television there last Sunday. And prior to that, about we were still kind of in the waiting game of if we were going to play or not. We made an application of quinclorac, which are drive to that field. We had a little bit of crabgrass out there that it was kind of widespread in just little spots, you know, just single plants and not tillered out too far. And I didn't want to have that stuff out there. And so we made that application. Well, so this is where we get to talk about failure, right? Because you don't learn if you don't fail, right? If you get, if it's all on easy street, then hey, it's easy. But yeah, so we sprayed that, and that was like on a, I think a Thursday, 2 or 3 weeks ago now, 3 weeks ago now. So like the following Monday, I get a call from the guy who's the groundskeeper, you know, at the stadium. And he's like, hey, there's these squares out here. And I'm thinking, what are you talking about, Bob? Like, you know, do we need to drug test you? Are you, I mean, he's an old guy and he does a great job and everything like that. But I just thought, no, you know, maybe Bob didn't have his bifocals on or something. And then a couple days later, I'm getting ready to go out there. And I get a call from my contact there, and she says, something's up and it looks bad. And so the best that she can do are these security camera footage shots, you know, just stills. And it looked like it looked bad. You know, I was like really, really concerned at that point. And so got out there the next day, took a look at it. And sure enough, you know, it had dinged it up pretty hard. And when I say ding it up, it just means like, you know, the upper leaf surface of what's exposed and what got sprayed. You know, if you see drive work, and if you've ever seen it just kill a crabgrass plant, it kind of gets that purplish mottled look on the leaf, and then it just sort of like fades out to straw color and it's dead. Well, this put that purple color into the leaf, but it didn't, and it kind of turned it a tinge of brown, but it didn't really kill it. There was still green tissue in there. So it was this real like limey, sandy green color that just looked awful. It looked really bad. And the worst part was, is that they didn't do a blanket app to the field. They kind of did spot treatment. So there was areas of green grass in the middle of the field, and right next to it was an area that was dinged up. And so, I mean, to be quite honest, yeah, I've, you know, a little freaked out because I knew what was coming up, and mm-hmm. we were, you know, 10 days out, 11 days out at that point. So, you know, work the problem, you know, so, you know, there's no time to feel sorry for yourself or anything like that. So I did some fertilizer apps, to kind of start getting it to grow out. And then I talked to a couple, academics, some guys that I know, deal with this stuff quite a bit. So the two guys I spoke to, Sean Askew, who's at Virginia Tech, and he's probably one of the preeminent guys in the country as far as, weed control on warm and cool season turf. You know, being at Virginia Tech, they kind of gives him the opportunity to look at both, you know, cool season and warm season. And so he had some really good takeaways, that I thought were interesting, and where, you know, he said you could spray this stuff, you know, 5 years in a row and have no problems. And then the sixth year, it just jumps up and bites you. And they haven't figured out exactly why, they're still looking at that. But his concern and the way that that particular product and that class of products works, those are ALS inhibitors. So they basically inhibit the auxin pathway, and auxins, A-U-X-I-N, those are growth hormones specifically targeted towards growth that are going to ultimately affect the plant. So it shuts down that pathway. Crabgrass can't grow anymore. It literally dies out. Well, what he said was with Bermuda grass, basically it shuts that down, but Bermuda grass, you know, you basically can't kill it almost. So it just kind of is unhappy for a little while. And I said, well, what's a little while? And he said, well, you know, it could be a week. It could be four. Mm-hmm. I've seen everything in between. So of course, at that point it's like, oh boy, like we're getting into some deep shit territory here. So, you know, and then it comes down to, I talked to James McCurdy over at Mississippi State, and they actually had a really interesting trial this year they did for their field day that ended up being online and virtual, but they tried to do this. They tried to induce injury with quinclorac on hybrid Bermuda grass. And so what he found, and they knew this was an issue, and they wanted to see if they could replicate it or figure out why. And they couldn't figure out why. Yet they've narrowed it down to a couple of things they think, but they are not sure yet. And the first one is temperature at application. So he said hotter temperatures seem to influence this injury a little bit more. They haven't, you know, proven that statistically yet, but that's one of their theories. And then the other one is actually soil moisture. So if you read the label for quinclorac, it actually says they don't want you to water a day before you apply and until 24 hours after you apply. And the reason for that is they actually want the soil to be drier because it actually affects the plant or affects the crabgrass plant even more. So in effect, wetter soil conditions, you can actually have the opposite. You can have less control. And so they think that on wetter soils, which this is an irrigated football field, you know, we're trying to keep it, you know, playable so that we've got cleats that go in and all that kind of stuff. We wouldn't be managing it near death. And so definitely the soils would have been, you know, slightly more moist than your average lawn situation or turf situation. And so that was something else too that we would look at. But yeah, so it was very, very dicey that week leading up to last Sunday of, you know, trying to encourage top growth and try to grow out of that stuff and mow as frequently as possible, try and mow off some of those damaged leaves, all that kind of stuff. It was full go, but We got lucky. We got 4 or 5 days of rain, just kind of quarter inch here, quarter inch there. And that pushed a lot of growth. And by Sunday, that place was glowing.
Yeah, so, the pictures that, and we can try to post something maybe on my website here where I post the show, but the pictures that you showed from the TV shots were amazing. So it looked spectacular.
Well, it was right up to the end there. So we did actually use a product, like a pigment product that I don't know that I've ever seen anybody in the lawn care community, at least on YouTube, post about this. But it's a company out of Florida, Naples, Florida, called Geoponics, and they sell a product called Endurant. And what it's typically used for is end of the season or, you know, end of fall season when you're losing that green color, you know, and the Bermuda grass is starting to go dormant. They'll apply the stuff and it'll green it up. It's just a pigment that naturally greens it up. And then you can also spray it on dormant grass and it'll make it look green again. So in that sense, you know, what we were trying to do is not necessarily just like paint the field. We were trying to get that to draw down some more heat from the sun and pull some more energy down and grow out. So it was a pretty interesting process to see all that kind of come together. I mean, definitely a case where a lot of resources went into it, not necessarily money, you know, per se, but just trying to get to those folks. And we've talked about this before. You got to know who to call.
Yep.
You got to try and connect with people that have been through that, who can maybe walk you through, even if it's one little, you know, nugget that you get. And that's really what it was just sort of putting this all together. So got fortunate with the weather.
How much gray hair did you gain during that period of time?
I was more interested in how much it was going to cost me to pack up all my shit and go move. Like, I figured I needed to be at least two time zones away.
This reminds me of Matt Martin's story about the first biochar like application.
Oh, the
to
football
that
field. Yeah.
When he was like, I was seriously considering just throwing my phone in the river and just getting out of there and never coming back because I didn't know what to do. But
this is a true story. So it was Thursday when I went down and actually saw it for the first time. So this is Thursday, the week prior to the game. So like we're 10 days out. And at that point it's like sinking in. It's like, this is not good. Like, this is a situation that's not good. And so Friday I go back. I mean, I was there, you know, more or less every day in between, just kind of checking and doing what we could do. But in any event, walk in there Friday and I'm walking down there with my client, my point of contact, and I see the football coach, the head football coach, pulling. I mean, this guy, he's a nice guy, and I've you know, built a good relationship with him. That he knows me, I know him, we know what we do, and we respect that. But he walks up to me and he says, Ryan, what the hell's going on here? And I said, Coach, we're working on it. And so at the same time, his wife's down there, and I feel really bad because she's a nice lady, and she's looking, as we're sitting there talking back and forth, she's just staring and looking back and forth at the field. She's looking at the green grass, then she's looking at the brown grass, then she's looking back at the green, back at the brown. So finally, we kind of, you know, end our portion of the conversation, and she asks, she says, Ryan, is this going to look right on TV here next Sunday? And I said, you know, ma'am, I promise you it will look good. And, you know, I knew it then, like I, you know, we had some high expectations and we had to deliver, and yeah, it took everything we had, but it was interesting. But yeah, that's a case of, you know, you learn on the fly. And so I think next year our weed control strategy, instead of quinclorox, we're going to trade that for a 12 pack of beer, a couple guys and some pocket knives, and we'll just go handpick that stuff out of there.
Yeah. Well, see, sometimes I think that I have a difficult situation because I have to show my lawn to hundreds of thousands of people on YouTube. But if I mess up, I just say, yeah, I messed this up. I probably won't do that again. And that's the end of it. But the thing that I like, you know, I've been following a lot more people that do what, you know, you do, or sports turf people on Twitter and stuff. And what I like about that too is you get to see a lot of the behind the scenes of what really goes on. Like, some of these things that they have at these stadiums, even major league stadiums, like in the middle of a year where they'll be like, let's have a Zac Brown band concert on this turf and have 30,000 people standing on the field. And then Monday, I'd like you to play a game again. And you're like, what? Why would we even consider doing this? But they do it. It's
They do that. I mean, Hard Rock in Miami. I mean, I think actually, no, this year. So this year it'll be Jacksonville. So Hard Rock in Miami, they've played like a Miami Hurricanes game at night. And then literally play the Dolphins the next day at a 1 o'clock start. Like, that's insane. I know this year, it's like November 8th and 9th, you've got Florida, Georgia playing in Jacksonville. And then the next day, so that's like a 3:30 kick. And then 1 o'clock the next day, it's the Jaguars. So it's like, that's intense. I mean, that kind of stuff. But, and especially in today's age of where pro sports and sports in general are going, you're going to see a lot more of that. You're going to see a lot more of, you know, those road trips for the baseball teams where if we can get somebody in here to do an event, by golly, we'll do it.
Yeah.
And there's sort of this whole cottage industry that's been built in the, at least in the football realm of, you know, they've got different names for it, but, basically like lay and play sod, like it's ready to go as soon as you put it down. You know, so they'll saw the week of and play a game if they have to. So, yeah, it's interesting when you get up into those levels and, you know, you talk about, you know, $200,000 or $300,000 to pull a field out and replace it in the middle of the season. And that's just, you know, the cost of doing business. But, it definitely does get interesting. But, yeah, there's some good follows out there for sure. I know you mentioned, I think in one of our conversations, Travis Hogan, with the Kansas City Chiefs. He's got a really great Twitter account and he's not afraid to show, you know, basically anything. I think that's
I believe I asked you, it was in another game of, does Ryan know this professional person? I asked you, because that's usually what the conversation starts. Hey, Ryan, do you know this person? And you're like, maybe sometime. Most of the time you're like, I know of them. I don't necessarily know them personally, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a small world when you get into turf in general, but especially sports turf. It's a very small world. So, and most of those guys are pretty engaging, and as long as they're not busy, would definitely talk.
Yeah, I was just thinking that he has kind of a unique, he has kind of that transition zone type of thing going on with a pro field, which might be kind of interesting to talk about sometime, because they have Bermuda in Kansas City, which. Kansas City is it's not that much different than my climate. So of course I'm definitely, we've talked about that too, hot enough here in like June, July, August ish, but then football starts fall. So it's starting to get down to that cooler part and what they'd have to do with all that. So it's unique there.
Yeah. I think last year, if I remember correctly, they only sodded going into the playoffs and they only sodded hash to hash, or just like a couple, maybe 15 or 20 feet outside the hash. So just in the middle of the field. And then every spring they will phrase that field out and resprig it. So they leave a little bit of what's there as far as the stolons and rhizomes and whatnot, but they sprig right on top of that. And they do that on their, training camp fields as well. So yeah. It's kind of a,
and I believe that field is heated, isn't it? I think.
I don't know for sure.
I thought maybe it was, but.
Yeah. But in any event, yeah. So it would be a good chat, and those are the type of people we can pull on here for sure. So
another field that I always really like is the Browns, which I know you follow. So
that's a great, that's a great field. That's heated for sure. And they do minimal sodding as well. They do a really good job of, in season, they might go down the middle of the field, that kind of thing. But they do a really good job of taking care of that stadium field. And I'm sure it'll be interesting to see how that goes forward, too, because I'm sure they're going to want to host more events and everything out there and all that, too. So be a good time here in the next 1 to 3 years to be a sand-based sod farmer if you're into that kind of thing.
I can't believe that we're only a week away from football, like pro football, and it's weird. I just, because of everything going on, I feel like I haven't even paid attention to anything, or I don't know that I'm not saying that I'm not excited about it, but I guess with most games being without fans, I feel like it's going to be a much different thing this year too.
It will be, but, and that's the same way I hear is it's just sort of like, you know, you work and life goes on and then, oh, wow, it's going to be football season. I think that's sort of how it feels this year. But yeah, football, I had that conversation too, like football without fans, you know, baseball without fans, basketball without fans. Yeah, that's easy to digest. But, you know, when somebody scores a touchdown, what would be great is if in all these sports, like hockey, especially, and probably football next, would be just mic these guys up with no fans and let us hear what they're saying.
Yeah.
Like, it's got to be some god awful shit that gets said, and I want to hear it. Yeah. So I'll pay extra for that. I'll pay, you know, an extra couple $100 for the Sunday ticket if I can get the unedited version. You know?
I agree. So, that would be, they need to do something to make it more interesting. And I've almost stopped watching all the NHL playoffs, which is unlike me because it's like I think the greatest sports like playoff of all. It's just, it's very exciting stuff. And, but it all feeds off of the fans and kind of how that goes when you're home and away. And it's just right now, I just couldn't really get into it very much.
I hear you. I think it'll be football might probably be a little bit easier to get into, but we'll see. But yeah, it'll be, I think we can probably get some sports turf guys on here to chat and share their opinions. Maybe not the football guys here, at least initially, but as baseball starts to wind down and some of that, it'll be, it'd be good to bring some of those folks on. So,
well, let's transition back to renovation stuff here. And then I think I want to talk about top dressing too, because I'm in the midst of hell right now. So, let's talk about the renovation stuff quickly. I got a couple questions, and something I experienced too on my bluegrass lawn that I'm renovating was about a month into it, and I'm seeing some spots that maybe there's a couple of bluegrass plants in there, but they're not really maturing, and there's not a decent covering there. So at what point for that do you recommend actually putting more seed down? You know, a lot of people that put down bluegrass, so it seems to me they think that, you know, you can just say, well, let's just let it spread. And you probably could, but why do that is the question.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to just let it spread, quote unquote, like it's going to take a while. Like it's not that aggressive unless you're really, really, really pushing it. So I'd say if you're a month in, and this is, okay, so we had this discussion, right, of why, you know, oh my gosh, you're going to seed in mid-August, and this is why you do it, because now you get to just past Labor Day and you still have a chance. You know, you still have soil temps that are up. I'm going to look here right now on, I've got one of my SPO sensors in the ground here. So we're sitting at 72 degrees here, soil temp on native soil. So yeah, so it's, you're still in the go zone there to get seed out. So I think if you're 4 weeks in and you don't see stuff starting to pop, like it's probably not going to pop. So that'd be an opportunity to go out there and just lightly dimple in some of those areas. And it just depends on how big it is, you know, because that's the other thing too that gets kind of hairy. And I know you've experienced this a lot is, I guess, well, how would you handle it? You know, when you've got grass that's starting to come up and get established, and then you've got to do more of a wide scale seeding to where it might not be, you know, big huge spots in just a couple areas, it might be just a whole bunch of smaller spots. Mm-hmm. How do you approach that when it comes to like not destroying what's actually good and you want to keep the, you know, the desirable stuff? How do you go about that?
Well, I've been on that yard that I've been working on is just kind of walking it, almost seeding some areas by hand kind of, and mm-hmm. just looking at what's there, what needs it, and then what doesn't. And we've been keeping the moisture going to where we knew we were going to be doing this sort of overseed. So we were planning on, you know, letting it, we have been mowing it now. So we were letting it dry out a little bit more so that we could actually get on it here and there. But now I kind of told my neighbor too, I was like, okay, we have the seed down. We mowed right before we did that. So now we can give it like 10 days or so and just let it go and let it even get a little taller if we have to in some areas. But it's just that it's that game that you have to play. But I just noticed in the last week or so that it's really starting to look like a yard, which is always exciting stuff. And the color has started to change, you know, when you get from that initial more of the lime sort of green color to where it starts to transition into the actual color of the genetic grass that's there. So
yeah, that's I think that's an important point too, is just seeing that shift is a good sign that you're pushing roots down and the plant is, you know, taking up nutrients, you know, out of the soil at that point, and you're seeing that transition, I guess, is that's what's happening. It's not just the color, but, you know, also you're rooting in the I guess the power and the function of those roots. That's a good thing. So yeah, you're right. It's a dance and a game where, okay, how much can I dry this thing out before it's going to hurt what's already there, so I can go in and do what I need to do. And yeah, that can be tough, but yeah, if you're a month in, I definitely would strongly consider that, especially given, you know, we're going to be here on the backside of Labor Day and be what, the 7th, 8th of the month here come next week. So yeah, that's, you know, you're starting to get in some areas, like you said, you know, that 56 degrees and that, especially that 40 degrees at night, it's going to drop your soil temps a lot. Now they'll probably heat back up, you know, when you get some sun and even moderate temperatures in the 70s, but that's going to be a slowdown. That's going to be a little hiccup there as far as moving things along. And so you've got to plan for those, and those hiccups are going to become more frequent and longer duration, you know, as we progress into the fall, and you've got to take that into account. So.
Yep. The other thing that I was noticing and that people maybe don't think about as much too with fall renovation stuff is sunlight, because my, you know, I even noticed my front yard now, the house basically shades it, you know, late afternoon. So you're getting much, much less sunlight time there. So that's why also you have to think about pushing your seeding slightly earlier, not just because of temperatures sometimes, but you have to look at your area too and say, okay, I know by the time I get into mid-September, I'm losing a lot of sunlight on this if it's getting shaded from the sun. So
there's a cool app. I'm trying to pull it up here on my phone. I think it's called Sun Surveyor on Android. Yeah, Sun Surveyor on Android. And I think there's another one, Sun Seeker, that's on iOS on the App Store. And it's a really cool thing to where you basically hold your phone up and it uses your camera and your GPS to figure out where you are, all that kind of stuff. And you can put in any date. So like if I wanted to put in, you know, today is, you know, Friday, September 4th. If I wanted to put in whatever October 4th is and see how much the sun angle is going to change on my lawn, I can program that in. And as I pan my phone across the sky from east to west, it'll show me exactly where the sun is relative to anything. So if I've got trees, if I've got the house, if my neighbor's house, whatever it might be that's an obstruction that's going to cause shade, you can kind of get a sense of where that's at. So at least, you know, you have an idea of how long you have before, oh yeah, well, by, you know, October 10th, it looks like the sun by at 2 o'clock or at 1 o'clock is going to go behind this tree or behind our house or something like that. So just another little tool to, you know, you don't have to guesstimate, you can actually look and see and use some pretty neat tools. So yeah, and it even helps too with, you know, it might help you decide, oh yeah, I need to prune one more branch up on this tree so that, you know, we get an extra hour and a half of sunlight at this time of year. So yeah, you can program it even for, you know, May, June, whatever, any day of the year, and you can see where the sun is coming across the sky at your place or wherever your property or the yard you're working on is, and give you a good idea of that. So
yeah,
that's powerful information. Good point.
That's cool. That's something. There's so many different cool technology things that you can utilize now. That sounds really awesome. I don't even think I have that, but I need to get that.
There you go. Sun Surveyor or Sun Seeker.
So let's go over one other question that I plucked from somewhere. It might have been a YouTube comment, I think. And it said, we may have talked about this before somewhere else, but I don't think we have on the show, but I'm having a bent grass problem in my blue rye lawn. Can you give me a suggestion on ways to get rid of this problem effectively? So bent grass. Yeah,
bent and blue. Yeah, so the chemical of choice is, well, you have two choices. One, non-selective, spray it out with Roundup and just get rid of the area, right? If you don't want to do that, and you want to go down the road of selectively controlling it, then obviously Tenacity is your best bet. And a couple tips, I think we didn't talk about this, but I actually just messaged somebody about this on one of the forums that you and I frequent. And so a couple of tips regarding this. One is start your apps now, and that more frequent lower rate apps are going to be better for you. So kind of the programmer model that I would follow, protocol that I follow, would be the 3.2 fluid ounces per acre rate. And then doing that 5 times, because that gets you up to your label limit of the year of 16 fluid ounces to the acre. That's the label limit. And basically you're going 5 days apart on those apps. So you make your first app, 5 days, you make your second app, so on and so forth, and you go through all those 5 apps. And the reason I say to do that is this stuff is a prize fighter, you know. So I'll give you an example of I had an athletic field here, this is several years ago, where had a bent grass problem, not super widespread, but enough that it was affecting things and needed to get it out. And so we were doing this protocol, and by the fourth treatment, you know, so we made 4 treatments at 3.2 fluid ounces to the acre. This stuff was deader than a doornail. Like, it looked awful. And I was like, there's no way this is alive, you know, of course. So we talked about this before, right? You know, you don't finish those last 2 antibiotics and, oh, I'm fine, I'm better, right? I don't need that stuff. What the hell does doctors know? They only went to school for 8 years. I've got a degree in turf science. I know better than them.
Yeah.
So, same thing. This stuff came right back. So, most of it, some of it got knocked back for sure, but so stay in the course. So tips on those applications. One, you definitely want to include a surfactant, a non-ionic surfactant, to help get that coated on the leaf, adding ammonium sulfate. So don't do the spreadable stuff. Make sure you get solution grade stuff to mix in there. Or you can get some liquid nitrogen products as well. That'll help it get in there. So that's just going to buffer your water down. Ammonium sulfate is your best bet there. So at 1 pound per gallon of spray, make sure you agitate it, mix it in there really well. And then in between these apps, so like on that 5th day before you spray, I highly recommend taking a rake and raking out as much of the dead stuff as possible. And the reason for that is, you know, it's a stoloniferous grass. So, you know, as that top layer is starting to die, and this, you know, it's a systemic chemical, but there's still new leaf tissue that's pushing out down below and trying to keep the plant alive. And the plant's doing everything it can to push new leaves out to try and survive. And so raking off all that dead stuff so that your application will get down in there and touch those new leaves and continue to translocate through the plant. That's a really, really crucial piece too. So non-ionic surfactant, 1 pound per gallon of ammonium sulfate in there to increase efficacy and buffer down your water. And 3, rake out before each successive app. But 3.2 fluid ounces to the acre, 5 apps, 5 days apart. And that's about the best you can do.
Sounds like great fun.
Yeah, it just makes you want to go out there and, you know, carpet bomb it with some glyphosate and just start over.
Yeah. So that's what I was going to say, is I'm definitely building my green on an island. That's what I've decided.
That's not going to matter. The stuff moves anywhere, moves on shoes, moves on anything. So there's actually, it's more so for Poa Annua, but there's a golf course here, very, very high end private club in Columbus, that before you go on the golf course, if you're a guest or even if you're a member, they take your golf shoes from you and they clean them with like Clorox beforehand to make sure that there's no like contaminated grass coming in from outside.
I can get new shoes, Ryan. I can get shoes. I can have my own mower for it. I can do whatever like needs that. To be done.
Yeah. What are these? Oh, these are my bent grass shoes. You're going to really, people are definitely going to think you're weird then, but
they didn't already. I mean, it's not a problem.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Speaking of that, let's move to my current project of sand top dressing my lawn, and let's talk about top dressing.
I can't imagine the looks you're getting from your neighbor. Actually, I can sort of imagine, but yeah. You know that gif of the guy that like walks up and throws out the lawn chair and sits down? That's what I picture like one of your neighbors doing, is just I'm just going to watch this, you know, sad sack go out there and shovel this into a wheelbarrow and just punish himself.
Yeah.
But I appreciate it. I appreciate the effort. So
well, my other neighbor came over, the one that I've been helping with his project. So he came over to, you know, go and deal with all the pain that I'm dealing with too. And he was like, I told him that last night. I said, you know, I'm sure everyone else around here is wondering what we are doing and why we're doing it, but they won't ask me. They'll just kind of like, you know, they just drive by and look. And he's like, I think if anybody does ask me, I'm going to tell them that he's done with the lawn thing. Like he's really tired of it. So he's adding all this sand to just kill everything off and make it like concrete.
There you go.
Yeah. I was like, well, okay, we're going to talk about this because the concrete talk is a good one too.
There you go. Well, that is a good one. But yeah, I do like the alternate plot lines thrown in there. I think you got to keep these people on your toes. You should go on the Nextdoor app with a bunch of like burner accounts and just start spewing all kinds of weird ideas of what you're doing over there.
Yeah,
that would be good. I'd be interested to see that. That'd be a good YouTube video. I'd tune in for that for sure.
Well, it's mostly like a neighborhood of somewhat my age group or slightly older, but there's like one older couple, and last night they were walking, or they do a lot of times like in the evening, and he came by and he was looking. He's like, now what are you up to now? And I was like, well, I'm leveling my everything. And he's like, with sand? What are you, like, I was trying to explain it to him, but then he's like, if I hang around you, maybe I'd learn something for it. So,
hey, it's, I don't know. There's not too many people that understand or want to understand, but you got to do what you got to do. Yeah. So,
okay. So my plan has always been, when I started reel mowing, that obviously once you start reel mowing, you learn really quickly that if you don't have a flat yard, it's not as much fun as you might think it is. So correct. If you're bouncing the mower around and it's just not that enjoyable. So that was kind of the thing. The last couple of years, I spent quite a bit of time leveling out my yard that I had there. And since I didn't kill off everything in like my front yard, I was like, okay, I'm just going to smooth everything out with pretty much the same topsoil that I have. And it's very, I'd say for what it is, it's pretty dang smooth. But sure. Now I got to that point where there's still a few spots here and there that I notice all the time. And the side that is about 2 years old now, I noticed, especially after I got my irrigation installed, it just never went back. And year after year here, it's gotten more and more bumpy and the soil changes with winter and all that stuff. So I decided I was like, I don't really want to do this because it feels like going down some sort of like there's no going back moment when you start putting this sand down, like the first shovel. But I decided to do it because I needed to learn anyway. And you know that I'm all about learning new things. So that's kind of what I decided to do. So my process was I went down everything with aeration, with core aeration, and I raked up all those cores, did all that, which is also not very fun, but I did use my Swordman to kind of pick things up a little bit better. Mm. And then at the same time, kind of thinned everything out, because once you cut down lower, it's you get all into that layer of, so I thinned all that out, and now back to actually doing the work of putting the sand on. And I ordered 8 tons, which might have been slightly too much. So
got a little overzealous on the order. Yeah, you're right that once you go down this road, there is no turning back. And I understand your apprehension, but look at it like this. You know, when you go out and you're like, man, you know, I really don't want to, you know, have a drink or have a beer or whatever. And you have that first one and you have a Frank the Tank moment. It tastes so good when it hits your lips.
Yes.
And then I'm telling you, you know, normally if we were at a bar, I'd say like, give me like 3-4 hours, but in this, give me like 3-4 years and you're going to feel awesome. So it'll be good. It'll be good. I promise.
3-4 years.
You just got to stick with it.
Thank you, Ryan.
Well, hey, you got to stick with it. You really, you know, really got to balance out the equity on that house so that when you go to sell it, you get all that money back for the, hey, look, you know, this is a full 4-inch sand cap right here. You're not going to find this in any other lawn in the Des Moines area, okay?
That's going to be the first line of the sale. I'll even put it on the sign outside.
Sand-based lawn. Oh, yeah, that doesn't, that, you know, that shit doesn't exist in the real, they're going to be like, dude, this guy's weird. Yeah. And you're going to be like, yes, I am, but you need to sell my house and I need all that money back for the sand.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's, you're definitely, you know, you're committing to it for sure, but you know, you're not going to solve, you're not going to get to the level that you want to get without doing it. How's that? And you're in a unique situation, obviously, with, you know, the presentation and the aesthetics and the quality that you need to have. And I think there are folks that are listening, you know, there is a point of diminishing returns, and I don't think you're approaching it at all. You know, where you're at and with ryegrass and with the tolerances that you have for your mowing height and all that kind of stuff, the equipment you have, yeah. But if it was somebody that wants to go down that route, then yeah, this is like the only path to really go down. Like you don't really have another choice. If you are just trying to casually do it, I think that's the dangerous route. You know what I mean? To where you think you can just sort of flip it on and off like a switch. Like it doesn't work like that. It becomes a part of your program and you've got to commit to it. So I always, that's the kind of thing that, you know, doesn't make me mad. Doesn't make me worried or concerned or, anything like that. I'm not sure what the right adjective is, but in any regard, you know, you see folks that are like, oh, I'm just going to throw some of that, you know, just your typical sand out there and let that just be my leveling. And then I'm good. I don't have to do anything. Well, between, you know, the organic matter that your lawn generates and the, you know, the weathering cycle that you go through, if you're in a four season climate like us, and especially like you're saying with winter, you know, with frost heave and things like that, there's no way that you could possibly keep that stuff. Now, this does open a can if you're going down the top dressing route for other issues where at some point that cap, you know, at your sidewalk or at, you know, fixed points of grade on the outside edges or even the inside edges, depending on where you're at, is going to present a problem because you're going to build up a cap higher than what you're, you know, what you're currently at as far as an elevation. And how do you deal with that? So
that's the problem is that mine is already slightly high anyway, and it's mm-hmm. going to get higher, but I'm kind of just going to look at it as like a raised dance floor at that point, you know, just.
Yeah, you could do that. And, so there's a guy on one of those forums that we frequent right now that I've been working with a little bit and just trying to walk him through and help him out a little bit is he actually excavated completely down on the subgrade and is building back up and resetting new grades because he wants to have a consistent depth of root zone all the way through. And then, so he'll top dress up, you know, as he goes, because it's not going to be just like a sand cap. It'll be a full, sand-based root zone, but it's still going to get to a point where, you know, it could be, you know, 4, 5, 6 years that he's going to have a grade correction to do. And so that's something to think about. So yeah, if you have a raised dance floor, now you're just going to have to put like a curb along the front side of their yard or something like that. And
yeah.
But then you can put an electrified fence or, you know, biohazard signs. I mean, there's lots of stuff you can do to scare people away from, you know, looking at, or just, you know, again, create that alternate narrative on the Nextdoor app of, oh my God, what's this guy going to do next? Mm-hmm. Got to keep him guessing.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk about the, first of all, I guess we should go back to like, why do people do top dressing in general? Is it just about leveling? Is there any other, I mean, let's also talk about a normal yard, I guess you'd say, quote unquote, because a lot of questions come from people all the time on, let's say I have a 2 to 3 inch yard, but it's really bumpy and I'm dealing with this in my backyard up until this project that I might have too much sand and might have to put some back there too. But over the years, it's, you know, with our earthworms and the, just the way that my soil is, it's gotten really bumpy back there, which it wasn't as bad when I moved in, but What can people do in that situation? Is it something we're talking about top dressing, or what's kind of your thoughts on that whole thing?
Yeah, so I mean, it can be used for the applications of top dressing are more than just, you know, a smoothing of the surface, right? Like that's a very, very big benefit of doing it with the right material. The other reasons might be amending soil. So whether that's from a top-down perspective or if you've aerated and you're trying to incorporate back in. So things like that, you could look at it that way too. So for somebody who's got that situation like you described, say they've got a normal, you know, 2 to 3 inch height of cut lawn, it's a little bit bumpy, and they want to do something. I mean, the easiest thing to do and to come by is if you just go get, you know, good loose shredded pulverized topsoil that's screened off of rocks and you sling it in there with a shovel, you're not going to find any really good piece of equipment to apply that, so to speak, like you would like a top dresser. It's not, it might go well, but it's got to be really, really dry. Like there can't be hardly any moisture at all in it for that to take place. And so that's more of, you know, a by hand and maybe a more targeted approach. Certainly you could do a wider area, but that's going to be a lot of work, as you well know.
Yes.
So, you know, you move into something like a compost and you get a little bit of both, right? So you're in the topsoil too, you're going to get what I would consider or hope to be, you know, as good or higher quality topsoil than what you have in the yard if you're slinging that stuff. And then if you, like I said, with the compost, again, adding organic material to it, to the lawn, to the system, and adding in some of the nutrients that go along with that. So whether it's, you know, a compost that's bulked with, say, yard waste, or it's bulked with biosolids, there's a number of other ones, but those are the two big ones. But if you've got something like that, yeah, it can help in a couple of different ways as far as, quote unquote, conditioning the soil. I watched a video on that this week that was interesting in some of the ways that they presented stuff. But in any regard, there's an opportunity there to incorporate some of that stuff where it's going to help with, like, you know, water retention in some aspects. It's going to help the physical characteristics of the soil as it goes down in there and gets, you know, mineralized as far as the nutrients go. And then as far as the organic material continuing to break down and become a part of the soil. So, you know, when we're talking about amending there, this is sort of the thing that got brought up in this video. And it's kind of made me think about it is there was a lot talked about the chemical characteristics and some of the things that can happen and some of the intangible things. They were talked about intangibles as far as soil physical properties. And so when we look at the physical properties of soil and the way we can amend those, it would be bulk density is probably the one I would look at the most. So bulk density is just a real simple term. Like bulk density, we know that water weighs 8.37 pounds per gallon. Well, in soil, we talk about grams per cubic centimeter, right? So, and there's sort of a range that we can go within that the lower the bulk density is, basically that essentially means that we've got more airspace in the soil. The higher the bulk density, we're going to get a more clay or finer textured soil that packs in there real tight, that sort of thing. So yeah, if you're using a compost, there's an opportunity to amend that and lower that bulk density in effect because you're adding organic material, which is lighter, and it's going to create more space in the soil, more porosity. So then sand, you know, why would we use sand? Well, it's clearly the easiest probably to manipulate as far as, you know, if you do have a level on or something like that and you're using it to spread it, it's probably the easiest thing to spread. And it's pretty ubiquitous in terms of, oh yeah, just your typical sand. And I keep throwing that out there because you told me that story about.
Yeah, we can tell the guy. Yep.
So go ahead. Tell me how the just your typical sand conversation started.
Well, so the struggle that I've been having and that I pretty much have been banging my head against the wall and asking Ryan Daly about, hey, I'm trying to find this sand, and we can talk about those specs again too, but I'm looking for a specific kind of sand to put and to use as my top dressing. Well, apparently in Des Moines, that does not exist because there's only a couple companies that really do this, and I've not been able to find anything with that spec. Most of the time, you talk to the people, they are like, I have no idea what you're doing, and this is what we have. If you don't like it, like, take a hike. So I have been looking and looking, and finally there's this new sand place that just opened up, seriously, like 7-8 minutes from my house. So I was like, okay. I tried to contact them, like any good company that's new, they didn't contact me back. So I was like, I'll drive down there. So I drive down there, I go to the little place, I walk in, and it's actually a lady that's there, and she kind of looks at me and she's like, hi, what do you need? I was like, okay, this is great.
Oh,
perfect. This is going to be awesome. So I asked, I was like, well, I'm looking for some sand. On the website, it said you guys might have golf sand or you might have Mason sand. I kind of wanted to know what the differences are. And she's like, we don't have either of those. And I said, okay. And she's like, well, that might be like when we, you know, we get our whole production running here, but we're not quite up to that. So you see all that sand out there? And she points out the window. That's all we have for sand. And I was like, okay, well, what's that? She's like, I don't know. I guess you'd call it your typical sand. And I was like, okay, see you later. So I just was like, yeah, that's not going to work. So I did a little more looking and eventually some calling around, and I found some Mason sand that I asked them about screening and how they did it, and it seemed like the person knew sort of what they were talking about. So I was like, this is basically what it's come down to, because the top dressing sand that they had had gone up to, which they can't tell you the spec on it. They still don't know. So it had gone up to $48 a ton and delivery, because it's on like the other side of the city, was like $120. And I was like, yeah, I'm not paying that. So
yeah. And that's what I'm saying. So, and this is why you have a better chance in that order. So we talked about, you know, topsoil, compost, and then sand. In my experience, and in talking with folks like you in different areas of the country, where you have a higher likelihood of finding good quality topsoil, number one. Below that, you have a slightly less but still good likelihood of finding quality compost. And then below that, you have less likelihood of finding good, what I would consider good top dressing sand. And so, you know, yeah, we could dive into the specs and spend a whole show talking about it. But, you know, the biggest thing when you look at sand are going to be the size and the shape, right? So we talked a little bit about that before. And so with the size, you know, imagine it, all that sand is not the exact same size, right? So imagine I have a big shovel or a bin full of stuff that ranges from a medicine ball down to a basketball, down to a tennis ball, down to, you know, a ping pong ball, and then like a pencil eraser, you know, that. And that's kind of the spread of different, you know, particle sizes that we have. And so when we classify sands and send them off to a lab, they will tell you, hey, you have so much of this size of sand. And it's a range. It's a very small range that they'll tell you within this, you know, this sieve, basically, as it filters down through this tube, it'll catch and end up in a sieve based on what size it is. And so for a top dressing sand, an ideal and good top dressing sand, there's the number 18 sieve, which is the medium textures of sand. And so with that, we'd like to see that sand be at least 60% of our total makeup. And the reason for that is, you know, if you get too coarse, it's going to be kind of beachy. It's never going to be super uniform in how it, you know, it doesn't necessarily compact, but how it sets up, you know, so to speak. So imagine walking on a beach. Now, if it's too fine, you know, imagine, you know, like a really, really hard, firm surface, because all those particles are packed tighter and tighter together because they're smaller. So with having the bulk of it be in the middle and then sort of a spread on either side, you have a good chance of like the structural integrity and stability of that sand, right? And so that kind of leads into the shape of the sand. So, you know, you go anywhere from a rounded shape sand all the way to what they would call an angular sand. So it's got more flat sides to it. and will pack better versus a rounded sand, which would be like if I had a cup full of marbles, let's say. Like they all rest on top of each other, but they don't fit together necessarily. Mm-hmm. So whereas the angular sands will set and pack up real tight. So again, we're looking to be subangular, really. We want to have some of those flat sides because we do need that structural integrity. But if we were to classify the particles of sand, we'd want those to be less, you know, we wouldn't want them to be rounded, but we wouldn't want them to be fully angular. So a subangular sand is sort of what we're after, if we can find that. Now, all those things I just said, if you went and talked to a sand place, they should know. Some of them might know, but not all of them will, for sure. And you can attest to that in your master's thesis on sand search and discovery, right?
Yeah, because that was I remember our initial conversation, I think, when I was asking you about this, and then you're like, okay, well, ask them. If they know, you know, they should be able to provide you this information. They should be able to tell you what everything is. And I was like, okay, Ryan, but you don't know exactly who these people are that I'm dealing with because they don't know anything. And you're like, well, you should just run far away from them. And I'm like, well, that'd be nice if I had options, but
yeah, and I think that's something too, where sometimes you have to, if you're 100% committed to the sand aspect of it, then taking matters in your own hands and saying, okay, hey, would you furnish me like a 1 gallon sample so that I can take it and send it off for a test?
Yeah.
So those tests, you know, $75 to $100. But again, if it's something that you're going to commit to over the long term, that's a small price to pay for one, and for two, to make sure that you have the right stuff out there and the problems that it could cause if you don't, mm-hmm. it's very much worth it. So,
well, and yeah. this is sort of where I landed on the thing was, you know me, I like to know exactly what I'm doing. And that's really the apprehension that I've had this whole time, was that I didn't feel like I knew exactly what material was going down. And so when I did my topsoil and I did all the sifting, and I knew exactly what was going down on the soil, and I knew that it was going to work for me and it wasn't going to cause any like long-term damage. But now I'm sort of at that point of, I wanted to try this, and let's take a look at my neighborhood. It's terrible. So if this is a guinea pig for me, and in the end someone buys my house and they don't take care of my yard like I take care of my yard, which is guaranteed. So it, I don't want to say, oh, I shouldn't care about that, but I'm just like, at this point, I sort of needed to go through the motions and learn myself. And if in the end it's a complete failure, I will just own up to that. But
yeah, and I think that's okay. I think, you know, and you know me, I'm one to know and see hard data and empirical evidence and yada, yada, yada. But there's also like the look test. Like, okay, if I look at this and I know what the speck of sand I'm looking for, I can tell you if it's close-ish. You know, if it's within reason, and you know, the stuff that you sent me a picture of, I think that's fine. I don't know that there'll be any major issues with that. Now, the lab test might bear out otherwise, and you can still adapt and overcome. I mean, I think the other thing too, there is, you can definitely screw some stuff up if you go with, you know, too big or too small of a sand, or too sharp or too rounded of a sand. There's no question about that, but for the most part, there's a lot of stuff that lies in the middle between those two things, especially when you go out in the marketplace and look, and if you're in the right area of the country and that sort of thing. But you're not going to screw anything up necessarily to the point where it's going to fail. It's just one of those things of, you know, why would I use something that, even if it's cheaper or whatever, that could cause me problems down mm-hmm. the road.
Yep.
So I get it.
Yeah.
But yeah, like we said, you know, finding, you know, as far as sourcing materials, topsoil is always going to be the easiest to find. Compost second, sand, like good top dressing sand third.
Well, and let's think about this too, is that, you know, I'm not putting down 4 inches at one time here. Like I'm putting down a light. That's another part that we should talk about, is how much should you put down? How should that method sort of work too? Because you don't want to go all willy-nilly. I got to throw that once in here today, but yeah, you don't want to go all willy-nilly like crazy just here at the start.
We don't know anybody who would do that, right?
No.
Nobody. Yeah. So, you know, getting on somewhat of a program, you could go as little as once a year, but I'd strongly recommend that you, if you're in a cool season situation, that you go twice a year and go no more than a quarter inch per time, you know, for each event. So that equals, you know, roughly about a ton per thousand, roughly. So do the math, double check yourself, make sure you're good. And from that aspect, you know, trying to work that in. Now you could split that up. You could go an eighth and go, you know, four times a year. But I think if you're in that wheelhouse of where you're essentially, you know, doing it twice a year and trying to get up roughly a half an inch down, I think that's fair. That's a really good and ambitious goal for sure. But I think you're going to see the best results out of that. How about that? Mm-hmm.
So if you were like, let's say you were lucky enough to find some sort of top dresser, like we were talking about, that could actually put that down on the lawn in a light amount, then essentially you could go more often, even if you wanted to. Like, you could put down, every once a month if you wanted to. I mean, that'd be a lot of rental and all that stuff, but
just buy one at that point.
Well, you know? Exactly. Yeah.
They're only $6,000 and you only have to tell your wife to park on the street for the rest of the time, but that's okay. I mean, that's just, I'm sorry, sweetheart. That's just the way that it works. You know, we have to protect our investment, and you know, your Toyota 4Runner just didn't meet the requirements for the garage anymore. So Sorry about that.
Well,
so no, yeah, that you're right though. You can definitely go more frequent. I mean, if you look at, you know, say a golf course or, you know, putting greens and that sort of thing, you know, amounts as light as, you know, talking about, let me think about tons here for a second, but like maybe, and again, grass height is completely different. You're talking about an eighth of an inch, so it can't accept nearly as much as even what yours could. But, you know, in that case, you know, we would put down maybe like 5 pounds per, you know, square. Let me think about this. 5 pounds per square foot. No. Yeah. About 5 pounds per square foot. Like that would be like a heavy top dressing on a putting green. So, you know, we would go out once every 10 days to 2 weeks at a very, very light amount. Like you could just, and that's what I'm saying, is kind of bump things along. So, you could definitely do that.
Well, and when we talk about there's no going back, let's talk about why that is the case and sort of what has to happen going forward from there, because I think that was really my anxiety about it, was just that, especially in a home situation, you have to understand now what's going to happen going forward.
Yeah. So you've got your layer of top dressing out there. This is, you know, at this point now it's a quarter inch or a half inch, whatever you've built up here in this initial round. So the first pitfall is, now when you pull a plug, right? So if you decide that you want to core aerate and pull a plug, those can no longer be, you know, dragged around, broken up, and pushed back into the holes. Those will all need to be collected. And the reason for that is, you know, your goal is to keep that layer of sand, not only to keep yourself smooth, right? But then also, you know, if you know, some of these folks that would be doing this would also be for, you know, improve surface drainage, right? So we want the water to pass through off the surface and get down to our subgrade or subsoil quicker. And in that case, by adding soil to it, you're going to slow down your infiltration rate dramatically. And so you've got to keep a full sand column, you know, a full sand cap above your soil layer. So removing those would be the first thing to realize that you're doing, right? That you're going to have to commit yourself to that. And then as far as, you know, organic material building up at the top. So as you continue to build that up, that level and layer where organic material lies is going to continue to build up. And if you don't do something to dilute it by top dressing it, right, then you're going to always face this layering issue, right? And so that's what you see in infrequently top dressed turf situations, whether it's a putting green or even a home lawn, is these layers, you know, these tiger stripes. If you cut a core and look at a side profile view, of, okay, there's a layer of organic and then there's a nice little layer of sand and there's a layer, and all that does is cause, you know, even more issues with infiltration, drainage, all those types of things. So it's essentially at that point, you can still core, you need to clean up your cores or do a solid core, a solid tine, where you're just pushing soil in and creating holes and then backfilling those. But in that sense, yeah, you've got to just stay on the top dressing and become, like I said, have that become part of your program each and every year there forward. Mm-hmm.
So I put down the sand and then I started using the level on to kind of get things smoothed out. But then I was brushing it all in as much as possible. So what's the key there? Like, how much of the grass needs to be showing back through, and kind of how does recovery go as far as time frame on that?
Yeah. So in a cool season situation, and especially fall and spring, you'd want much more of your grass showing. You know, you see these pictures of, you know, Bermuda grass where you literally, you can bury it and it just grows right back up through. Not as much. And especially with like perennial ryegrass in your case, where it's a bunch type grass, it's not going to tiller out or do anything funky like that. So what you see is what you get. So, I would just try and keep it to that quarter inch. Now, if you're at a super low mowing height, like a half an inch or something like that, you might back that down a little bit. So in that case, again, we're going to use that conversion factor of 1 ton per 1,000 square feet equals roughly a quarter inch. So in that case, you might only be at half a ton to try and get your rate right and keep enough grass above ground. And so in that case too, with ryegrass, I don't know, are you going to overseed or do anything like that? Are you just thinking?
Yeah, I think I'm going to. I was just going to anyway, like usually every fall after I clean things out and just whatever has died after the heat of the summer, usually I just go through and do some overseed. So I was probably going to lay some on there and then try to rake that in a little bit too. And then that was going to be my plan.
Yeah, I think on a bunch type grass, so perennial ryegrass or tall fescue, you almost have to do that to a certain extent because you're not going to have that same density pushing up through. You might get some of that stuff to go back up through, but recovery wise, I think that would have to be part of the plan. Bluegrass, maybe not to that same extent, but you know, it really does depend on your application. I think with by doing it by hand and having to sling it and everything like that, you're clearly covering up more than you would if you actually had, you know, a proper top dresser, to where, you know, those eco lawns, which is sort of like all the rage in the home lawn or landscape market, you know, are these small, you know, they kind of look like concrete buggies. If you ever seen guys, you know, install concrete like that in tight areas, but they've got a dual spinner on them. So it's almost like a fertilizer spreader in a sense, where, but it's got two spinners on it instead of one. And, you know, you're just like dusting the grass as opposed to throwing it down right on top of it and smearing it all over the place. So if you want to have more of that clean, polished look after, regardless of what grass you have out there, that's definitely the way to go. If you can get an actual top dresser in there. So mm-hmm. Beg, borrow, rent, whatever you can do.
And as far as going back to your mowing and all of that, how quickly, I mean, obviously on greens and stuff, you're going back to mowing right away, but you're also, like you said, putting down such a small amount. But
well, so on greens, you know, like let's say we'll take it two different ways is greens, typically that next day we would just roll. We would not mow greens again the okay. following day. Try and minimize sand pickup because we were collecting clippings. Now, in a lawn situation or even like a sports field situation, let's say, where you're probably not collecting clippings or your mowing height is slightly higher. So say half an inch or higher. In that case, I would probably still let it go a few days. So like the picture you sent me of your lawn, I wouldn't go back out there with a real mower for, I don't know, at least 3 days. I just let it kind of go. Yeah. And let yourself grow up through that sand a little bit. And the other thing too, that you really need to be careful of if you're real mowing, is sand versus a reel and a bed knife is no bueno. That's mm-hmm. going to dull you out very quickly. And, you know, to the extent that even a back lapping might not be enough. You probably, you know, likely would have to pull that bed knife on, put a new one on, get it ground, and then grind your reel and be ready to go back out there.
Yeah.
So very, very much a concern if you were going to do that. If you give it some more time and you have to adjust your mowing height up and then bring it back down, you know, over the course of a week or two, you know, after the fact, you know, in certain cases, like on greens, after say a full aerification, there's times we would wait even 5 or 6 days,
yeah.
You know, so, and start, you know, where we were at, say, an eighth of an inch, 125,000. So we might start at 160 and work our way back down.
Well, know, I was considering, so I was cutting it 3/4 of an inch this whole year, or like the whole main heat of the summer. So I cut it down to 1/2 inch before I put the sand down in order to sort of start there. And then I was going to let it grow back out some to probably get up to about 3, like the next mow, maybe 3/4 again. So let that kind of grow out for a little while, or even maybe let it grow out even more and do like one rotary and then go back down. But
no, and I've seen folks, I've played around with it a very small amount, but where, you do that and you use your PGR ahead of time. So, you know, let's say that you were top dressing today, 3 weeks ago, you figure out, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to hit my rebound right after I've scalped it, and I'm going to, you know, jet it right back up. And sometimes too, another tactic would be, say, you know, you knew we were going to do this today. So maybe Monday of this week, you know, 3 or 4 days ahead of time, you went out there with just, you know, a small amount. So say, you know, less than 1/2 pound of 100% all mineral nitrogen source. So ammonium sulfate or urea, and just gave it a little bump. So it's, you know, you kick it in the ass and get it ready to go. And then as soon as you scalp it, it's like, oh, what happened? And then naturally it'll kind of, that fertilizer will kick in. And sometimes if you get that, not sometimes, but if you have that PGR in the mix too, you can kind of get a really, really fast recovery out of that.
And so, I didn't get fertilizer down beforehand, but I was thinking too now of even getting something down like a maybe liquid or something fast release to kind of get it jumping again too.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's a good plan is, you know, go out there and bump it along, and that, that'll help for sure. But yeah, if you do that and front load it a little bit, you can see that stuff recover very, very quickly for sure.
That's so good. So I miss my mowing and I, you know, I mowed a couple days ago, so I need to get back to this.
Jeez. Get, you know, let your back heal in, you know, before get through all 8 tons first and then we'll talk about mowing. Right. Yeah,
I know. So I think there's one other thing with the top dressing in terms of the concrete thing that we needed to talk about, because that's the main thing that everyone says, well, sand and water and everything else, okay, you're going to make concrete on your yard, why would you do this? So
it's just your typical concrete, you know, it's no big deal.
Yeah.
So this there is some validity to this, but it's like a lot of things, you know, whether it's an old wives tale or, you know, people say something and it's like, well, do you really know what the hell you're talking about? And, you know, I appreciate their, you know, their cautionary tales and everything like that, but it's not going to cause concrete. And here's why. So the only way that it could cause concrete, let's talk about that first. So the way that you would cause concrete, and I've seen people do this and it will definitely screw some shit up, is I'm going to take a certain amount of sand, a certain volume of sand. I'm going to put it either in or over top of the soil. I'm going to till it all together and it's going to make this super soil. That's, you know, like, you know, we've got all this organic material and we've got some fines in there to hold water and nutrients, but we've got all this sand. And unless you're going to do that to the extent that you're like 85% plus sand, it is not going to work. And it's going to go south real quick. So in that case, what we're talking about doing, and this is what you're starting right now, is what we would call sand capping, right? So you're going to cap over native soil with a coarser soil, in this case sand, to create a different layer profile for yourself to grow and for yourself to mow and use on the surface, right? And so this whole concept is over 100 years old. I mean, they've been doing this on golf courses since the turn of the 20th century, where, you know, sand top dressing was around before that, but they figured out that, you know, hey, we build up on top of this native soil, we can actually get better turf, right, through this whole process. And this has sort of expanded out into a number of different areas in fine turf management. So like, you know, top dressing fairways on golf courses really become in the last, you know, say 15 to 20 years has become a more common practice. It's not very common at all, but especially at places with a budget that can afford it and support it. Definitely.
And when you say better turf, why is growing it in sand better? I think that's something that should be talked about too.
Well, porosity in the soil and bulk density, right? So I can't compact sand the way that I can compact a finer soil. So, and this is the reason why it works. Here's the thing that you can't do. Fine over coarse, no good. Coarse over fine, okay. So in this, here's a good example, and this is a more a sports turf type of thing, but this happens a lot in construction projects. So where, we want a sand-based root zone because it's going to drain really well. Okay. Yeah, and we need to sod the field too because we need to plant it right away. Oh, okay. So, you know, there's not that many places that grow sand-based sod. Well, no, there's a place, you know, right down the road, and they've got sod. It's sod, right? Well, no, they're growing on native soil. Well, yeah, you can just put that right on top of the sand. It's like, no, you're going to have fine over coarse. It's not going to drain. And in a sports field setting, you create what's called a shear plane because it literally can't root in. And as soon as somebody steps and pushes off on their foot's going to give way because there's nothing holding that in. So that's a bad deal. So coarse over fine, though, we're allowing water to move down through. And so if that cap is a half an inch out, there's not a whole lot of holding capacity there. But as you move up and you get into a depth closer to, say, you know, 2 inches plus and then 3 inches plus up to 4 inches, you know, now there's some pretty good holding capacity within that soil for water to move down. And so we talked about this a little bit, I think, before, where it doesn't mean that you ignore what's down below, right? It doesn't mean that you ignore that native soil that's down below. You've got to still, in those cases, and it can get tough in a home lawn situation, I'm sure, if you get a cap that's like 3-4 inches deep, because a lot of the commercially available aerators are not going to push past that. And so what I mean by manage that is still create openings in that space. So like in a sports turf setting, we would use a deep tine machine to try and poke holes to keep that interface open so that water's still able to move down through. We don't want to create a bathtub necessarily, mm-hmm. where it's just sitting there, but we still want to create that. So create that interface where water is able to pass down through. So yeah, that is that concrete thing is it's a myth unless somebody tries to take a tiller out there and thinks they're going to change a soil by adding just like, oh, I can just put like 50% sand in there. 50-50, that sounds good, right? No, that's not going to work. And so, but I've seen people do it. You know, there's a sports field builder here in Ohio that has had really, really good luck using slightly larger sand than like the spec that we were talking about before, a USGA green spec. So this is a sand that's graded closer. It's like a concrete sand almost is what they would call it. And it's got particles that go a little bit closer to like 2 millimeters on the sieve, which is pretty big. Anything past that's considered gravel. But they've had really, really good luck with amending native soil to like 80 to 85% of this sand with the soil and tilling the hell out of it. And it's actually produced a pretty good root zone. I think in recent years, this is sort of what's come up is, and this is something that was researched at Michigan State. So like about 10 years ago, there's a gentleman there that did his master's thesis, PhD thesis, actually, I think, on sand caps for native soil fields, and specifically in a sports turf setting. And basically what he was trying to do was figure out, okay, hey, we're probably not going to amend because that's going to create or the need for a huge volume of sand. So if I need to amend 6 inches of soil with 80% sand, that's an ass load of sand, right? So how can I build up a cap that we can play on that'll still perform like a true sand-based system that's, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12 inches deep, whatever it would be, depending on the material. And so what he found was that, you know, just 2 inches of sand created a playing surface that was, you know, that was more than stable, more stable than any native soil field could ever be. And, you know, he was doing it for a fraction of the price. And so that's been, and that's been adapted. And then you've seen folks, like I said, top dressing fairways, and particularly out on the West Coast, like the Pacific Northwest, rainier climates, where they have to, because they need the revenue. If it's all soil and they try to send golf carts or golfers out there, it's just impossible. But if they've got that little sand cap, there's enough holding capacity in that soil that they can get carts out. They can play golf on days where they otherwise couldn't. So that's what we've seen, is that just this little layer of sand is enough to make an improvement. And like you said, you know, what's good mean? Well, it means denser turf. It means more well-rooted turf, all those types of things. But it also takes into account that you're managing that interface between coarser material and finer material. So that's where it could get a little bit tricky, I think, in the home lawn setting. But hey, it's a good reason for you to have to justify a need for a deep time machine. So yeah, I think we're good here.
We're up to, I need a Pro Core, I need a top dresser. I need, like, I'm going to need a building here to hold all this stuff pretty soon. And I need a big budget, which I don't currently have, but
you have to strive for something, Ryan. So we'll get there.
The aerating, I was like, I think that Pro Core is on the top of the list. I'll tell you that.
Man, when that thing came out, that was 2003 or 2004. So like all the machines before that, the wheels were set outside of the aerating heads, right? So every time you'd make another pass, you'd run over like,
That's what was happening, is I got one of those reciprocating ones that you can't really find very easily for homeowners, which it's nice because it's not beating you up as much as the other type is, but also you go down one pass and then you come back, and just like you said, you're smashing down the other cores. And for me, I had watered and we had like 1/10 of rain that morning, but it was still wet enough that it was just sticking to the tires and just created a big, huge mess. So
yeah, that when that thing came out, it was, there have been very few pieces of equipment in the last, whatever, 25 years or so that I can remember seeing equipment and seeing all the failures that have come along just the same. But that is a truly transformational piece, with the wheels being set inside. And then it's a really good machine too. It offers a lot of versatility in terms of the way that you can set it up, as far as spacing, as far as depth, as far as the different tine arrangements that you can have on it. All those things play well. So you would very much like it because it's very customizable. You are definitely not a one track guy. You want the full box set, you know, to really get into the deep cuts. And this is exactly what the 648 does.
That's right. So I think I'm going to move my Christmas present wish from my wife from a grass prism to a Pro Core.
So. Yeah, it's slightly, you're going to need to add a comma to that figure, but yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're almost up on 90 minutes here, and I need to get back outside and keep working here before it's supposed to be 88 degrees today, and it's almost 1 o'clock, so I'm getting into the prime time.
Hopefully you've hydrated and you're ready for another day. But yeah, it's, you know, hey, you just got to keep slinging it until it gets out of the driveway, right? I mean, there's no choice at this point. There's no turning back.
Nope, there's no going back now.
Doesn't it feel great, Ryan?
I don't know. I'm still scared.
That's all right. Like I said, it's like playing craps. The dice are in the air. They're going to hit the table and something's going to happen. Who knows if it's good or bad, but you got to love the action, you know?
Yep, I know.
Yeah, so. All right, well, hey, best of luck on the work. Be safe. Be smart and send pictures too. I'm excited to see the finished product.
Yeah, I will, and we'll follow up, I'm sure, on our next episode with what happened and how sore I got and how many keystones I needed to drink. So,
yeah, I'm going to put the over under, and we'll let our listeners chime in. But I'll put the over under when this is all said and done at I'll say 10.5. Okay. 10.5. see if people take the over or the under on that. So
I liked your last night when you said if you were icing your back with keystones, that's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, you transfer them, you know, you gotta have enough in the cooler so that you can drink one and ice one, and then you just keep recirculating until you're all out of keystones.
That's perfect. That's perfect.
Oh, man. All right, well, hey, enjoy it, be safe, and we'll talk next week.
Sounds good.